Well, good morning. I'm going to just jump into this pretty quickly because I feel like I have a lot to say, and you will have to use the shepherd's hook to pull me off, so I know that already. I wear many hats at the college, at my campus, and none of them are as a soil science instructor. I'm an earth and environmental science instructor, so I teach a wide breadth of natural science classes, including environmental science, geology, wetland courses, geography as well. I'm known by my colleagues as a dirt diva, and the students call me a muck instructor, but I don't actually teach any soils classes, and so I've weaved soils into all my classes. All of these classes have a healthy dose of soils. Excuse me. And these classes are combinations of lab, non-lab, and also hybrid classes. And hybrid classes are classes that are taught partially online and partially face-to-face. These classes are primarily freshman and sophomore level. The wetland ecology class is more of a 300-level class, but primarily my meat and potatoes are freshman and sophomore level classes. I've had a lot of challenges and successes. Fortunately, now at this point in my career, the successes are far outweighing the challenges, but I think it's worth noting that some of these challenges might arise as you bring soils into your classes. I find that with non-majors textbooks, I find errors, actually, and so I've written to editors many times correcting them. There's also oftentimes a lack of details, and so I notice, like in a general environmental science text, there's three chapters on water, three chapters on atmosphere, and there's one tiny chapter on soils. So I supplement quite a bit, and I correct and add, enhance the soils module. My biggest gripe with these textbooks are the idealized figures and kind of cartoon animations that, you know, like for a soil profile that, you know, students have this misconception that it's O, A, E, B, C, R, and that's how it always is and always will be. So that's probably my biggest gripe, I guess, is the some of the figures lead to misconceptions about what soils are all about. Similar to what the previous speaker talked about, my audience is largely non-majors students, and actually to boot, non-science types. And so about 85 to 90% of my students are taking my class because they need to take a lab class and get that off their checklist. So as such, as there's quite a bit of disinterest in science, period. And when I start talking about dirt, anybody who's a soil scientist probably knows you mentioned soil and people's eyes glaze over and their eyes flip back into their head and they're really not very interested in it, period. I also have a lot of my students have a fair amount of anxiety being in a science class, period. I'm also known as a challenging instructor, apparently, so I have a reputation. So they have quite a bit of fear coming into my class. I have combated this, but with active learning. And I think this really offsets all the other challenges because I do a lot of active learning and outdoor labs, and I think that provides much more of a connection piece between the disconnect with what textbooks are providing and the brevity of information. This active learning component is something that I really ascribe to very strongly. I think that if students are out there doing it, they're getting their hands dirty, literally and figuratively, that it is a much better process for the learning component. As you start to weave soils into your classes, I think it's really important to remember who the audience is. We're not preaching to the choir. They're not soil students. They're not science students a lot of times. Excuse me. And so I always consider what is an appropriate and relevant objective for the class. So depending upon, you know, if it's a geology or geography class, I might have different expectations. A good example, I feel, is that all books seem to have the soil textural triangle in them. And I personally don't think it's necessary for my students to memorize all the soil textural classes and the percentages because it's very much out of context. I'd rather them learn about what soil is, the properties, and what this means. And so I don't have them do a lot of memorization. I do a lot of activities instead for them to learn about kind of how the engine works, so to speak. Since I did undergrad and my master's with soils, I seem to think in the dirt all the time. I can think of class-related applications fairly easily, but I think what's really nice is that when we talk about soils, we often talk about them in a very isolated fashion, and we pull them out of the context of a bigger holistic picture. So I like to put some sort of a big case study at the end, so that kind of puts it back into the idea that this is part of a holistic, you know, ecosystem, and it's part of the atmosphere and the hydrosphere, and it's interacting with everything else. So to do that, though, I think the best way to do this is to build a solid foundation first. And I do this with teaching the five soil forming factors. And these soil forming factors, I'm not going to go into them because I am preaching to the choir now. The five soil forming factors, I find that I can relate this to anything and everything. No matter what my class is, I can tailor it and talk about this. It's also really nice because I think the level of discussion and the terminology can be tailored to the audience. So for example, I've done this twice. I've done a STEM workshop for middle school girls, and this was not a part of my college campus, it was something separate. And what I did was, I actually purchased pigments. I actually used some iron minerals I synthesized as a grad student the first time, but this time around I made it easier for myself. I bought the pigments. These are from natural soils and minerals, so they're not altered in any fashion. I made some paints with them, and then I presented these. I had 15 minutes actually to talk about soil forming factors with these young girls, and then I let them loose, and they painted. I asked them to paint something science-related, whether it was abstract or not, and they went to town, and they had a really great time, and this young girl did me really proud. She made a soil profile without me prompting any of this, so that was really nice. I'm showing this kind of in a very quick fashion because, one, there's no hyperlinks, we found out in this room, but the other thing is when I created this module, I was part of a geoscience learning community in the Northwest region, Pacific Northwest region in Seattle, and they asked me to develop a module for an online activity for a collection that all instructors could access. And I was in a room full of geologists, geographers, atmospheric scientists, and I was the lone soil scientist in that room. So I decided that I was, no matter what I did, I was going to do something to carry the torch to talk about soils and sustainability issues. So I developed this module. It feels a little bit outdated now because there's so many more things out there in listening to this symposium. So there's a lot more robust activities. I think now mine's really, you know, kind of old school, I guess. But it does provide some framework for a soils instructor who has maybe a little bit of knowledge to get up and running, to develop a lab. I developed some cheat sheets and some hints and questions and so forth. And this is open access as well, and anybody can get to it. The idea behind this, though, I've pulled some of this, and I use it in my classes, though. And so part of this aspect is I try to make soils more reachable to all students. So I have them do soil texturing, but it's not the way I learned how to do it. I just want them, I'm trying to get them to realize there is a difference, there's some variability. These properties influence other aspects of soils, like water relations. So I for my environmental science class, for instance, I just have them try to, you know, put into, is it more sandy, is it more loamy, or silted clay? I'm not trying to get them to differentiate between a loamy sand and a sandy loam. That's impossible for them to do on the time scale that I have. So this is purely my cheat sheet. I give it to my students, they work with it. And depending upon the class, I have different kind of cheat sheets, if you will. So again, I'm tailoring it to my audience, what is a reasonable expectation for them as well. And I'm not trying to make it too difficult or overwhelming for them to do this. I love to get their hands dirty. And I tell them that I'm gonna check their fingernails before they leave, otherwise they can't leave my class. So they get their hands dirty. I also think it's really important to get them outside. No matter what, all my classes, even my non-lab classes, get outside. I take them outside at least once. Excuse me. I have them do soil profiles, and I use topography as a variable because within a very small distance, they can see how tweaking one soil variable changes the whole situation. And so I also think about horizons with them. It's not reasonable for them to try to map or do anything like that. I know that's not what they're doing. My objective for this is I want them to understand there's variability in soils and a lot of complexity. So I have them just use master horizons and they use color and kind of my cheat sheet for texture and compaction and stuff like that. So it's really simple. This is an hour and 40-minute lab. They get out there, they get their hands dirty, they get some hands-on experience, and it works. They have a full appreciation that they realize there's a lot more variability to soils. It's not just this brown dirt blob that, you know, is just present in there. This, as opposed to all the other sessions, I think I'm giving you kind of the buffet of a lot of different activities instead of focusing on one thing. These are things that I've used. I get really good feedback from this, and so that's why I'm showing you these. This is a lab I do. Any undergrad soils student uses this lab to look at cation exchange. And what we do is we look at different dyes and we mix them and see what elutes from the after they've interacted together. And in my class, I use a sand, a silt loam, and a sand plus humus. And my whole reason for this is because I'm trying to show them that humus is a rock star in the soils. And it's so important for agricultural sustainability, as well as carbon storage and relations. And I also, in my soils labs, I try to tie it back and thread it back to that it's part of other concepts as well. So we revisit the nitrogen cycle, and they apply ammonium and nitrate as ions. And they, in after doing this lab, which is very visual, it incorporates different learning styles. ammonium and nitrate, they apply this and think about, like, well, why does one get into the groundwater and one sticks around in the soil? Why is there a greater potential, at least? Excuse me. So my main goal, this is, again, these are 1 hour and 40 minute labs. So it's really quick, it's very visual, and students get the aha moment. They really connect things. Another quick lab I have, I shouldn't say quick, it's an hour and 40 minute lab. I do erosion simulations. You'll see that's very fancy equipment. These are rain gutters I cut in half, put chicken wire in the base of it, and the on-site effects, right here, this is basically simulating a hillside. They spray water on it, and then the material that comes off on two different simulations, they can see that this is the off-site effect, so like an aquatic waterway. And they really, even though it's kind of a simple concept to understand, to see this really turbid, muddy water, and I relate this to what's happening outside in the rivers, and we think about photosynthesis and trophic structures, they really get the idea. I'm like, would you want to be a fish in this? You know, this is what's happening. This is a very small, quick simulation, but they really get the idea. I also, in the same lab, I do, we look at vegetated and like a half-vegetated simulation, and with the idea here that vegetation, just a simple cover of vegetation, even if it's rather sparse, actually reduces erosion significantly. And so they actually do measure the turbidity in the waters using a turbidimeter, and the water is so much more clear just from even a half of a little strip of vegetation. And the other really cool thing about this is it mimics tillage operations, so it's basically like a contour strip cropping simulation as well. So, some food for thought. This is just some quick ideas that I've kind of threaded together that work well. So topics that you can kind of have like a domino effect, I guess, from different classes. So from environmental science, I think talking about soil sustainability leads right into agricultural sustainability, which ties right into food security and population growth. And population growth, everybody's talking about it. Even our opening speakers addressed population growth. Humus and horizon development, especially when we think about O and A horizons, leads right into carbon storage and climate change. And everybody's heard of climate change, but most of the focus usually is on trees and that capability to store it. So when my students start realizing, wow, that, you know, the depth and level of the O and A horizon have a profound influence on carbon storage, their eyes literally pop open. I mean, and the fact that soils store more carbon is really profound to them. So erosion is a really big topic in my environmental science class because it relates to so many other environmental issues. Talking about eutrophication and turbidity and how this ties into trophic structure, food webs, and keystone species. And this may seem not quite as intuitive at first, but what I use for this is I like to talk about the reintroduction of wolves at Yellowstone. And what they found is that not only was there the kind of they predicted the predator-prey relationships would change and that the elk would not hang around so much near the stream banks. But the reason why I use this at this point is because the reintroduction of the wolves in changing the predator-prey relationships. Now the elk are not hanging around by the stream banks anymore. They're not browsing the vegetation as much. The vegetation's recovering. The stream banks are not eroding as much. So the water quality and quantity is much different in Yellowstone. So there's this whole cascade of changes that have occurred just from putting a keystone species back in and the effects it's actually having on the whole system. So I see lights going on in their heads as well for this one. Erosion, of course, ties into agricultural sustainability, and all of this leads right back into ecosystem sustainability. So one of my take-home messages that students learn from me is that if we could control erosion, we'd solve a lot of problems with water quality and quantity issues and just a lot of different things, salmon spawning, et cetera. When I started teaching geology, I realized that people weren't nearly as interested in rocks and minerals as I was, and I got glazed over eyes. So I started doing the so what, meaning it's my class is also like more of an applied geology, so an environmental geology aspect. So I started teaching this after we taught about, you're making me nervous standing up. After we talk about soils, I revisit the topic of plate tectonics because that was something earlier in the quarter. And so we talk about I present a case study to remind them, and it's an activity, a small group activity, where I provide some papers and maps and things like that. They revisit the idea of plate tectonics, how plate tectonics form in the Himalayan mountains, and the Himalayan mountains are eroding, weathering, and this material is depositing down in the lowlands. And this weathering and just these natural processes are actually creating a major problem in Southeast Asia with arsenic poisoning in the groundwater. So tying the scientific concept and kind of watching the effect and tying it to a human interest topic at the end all of a sudden gets their connections going as well. I'm almost done. So soil and geography, I'm just going to give you one quick example here. Soil development obviously leads to soil fertility, which influences where humans have settled. So I try to tie the physical environment back into the human geography aspect as well. This leads into food and drink production. And people are always interested in wine. And so many years ago, I found this bottle, and it had, I'm drawn to the label, of course, because it was a root and trees, and I grabbed it, and I bought it because it talked about Chilean wine and climate and soils, and it was everything all in one shot. I thought, this is a great bottle. I'm going to buy it. Fortunately, the wine tasted really good, so I went back and took one for the team, and I bought 5 more bottles, drained them all, can't bring alcohol on campus. I have 6 bottles now in my office, and now we use them as a small group activity that kind of ties in the idea that soils influence, you know, food and drink production, and it's very interesting for students to kind of read it firsthand holding it. So, in conclusion, I'm just going to wrap this up in saying that the labs I have, you know, the way I've done it and so forth, it seems to work. Students, they walk in with glazed eyes over eyes, they walk out and they're excited about soil and they talk about it, they remember it later, years later, they come back. And in my soils lab, after the texturing and horizon development, after they look at soil pits, in their lab, I ask them to reflect on soils and what did they learn. There's no right or wrong answer, I'm just asking to reflect on it. This happened last week. I graded the labs, and one girl said, soils are significantly more interesting than I had originally thought, as I had, like most, had dismissed them as being a very simple and boring system. Now I am actually incredibly interested in learning about soils, as I think these have been the most thought-provoking and fun labs we have done thus far.